TV Bible Study is a serious effort to study in depth every word of God. Each 30-minute lesson has been carefully arranged to assist you with your study of God's Word. And now for your TV Bible Study teacher, Richard Rogers.
Welcome again to TV Bible Study. We're involved and have been for a good while in the study of Bible history. We're studying right now the history of the Hebrew nation. In particular, we're looking at the books of Joshua through 2 Chronicles. This makes the 32nd lesson in this series of Bible history. We're going to look today at the concluding story of the Judges. Not this time in the book of Judges, for we finished that study last time. But now in the book of 1 Samuel. For the last two judges, Eli and Samuel, are found here in the book of 1 Samuel. Now Eli is the 14th judge of Israel. And he's more than a judge. Eli is also the high priest. Now Eli's judgeship is really told in order to tell the story of the early days of Samuel before he's judge. And so much of what we're going to say will deal more with Samuel than it does with Eli. And yet we're dealing with Eli's life. Now Eli's life, before we're through with it, will have 6 points. But I want us to look at them rather than all at once to get the flow. I want us to look at them one at a time in order to let the story build, so that the climax that comes at the end of Eli's life may be seen in more of its power by leaving it under the very last. Let's look, first of all, at Hannah's prayer. Now, Hannah is not in any way connected to Eli. She is the mother of Samuel, and she is one of those barren women. You remember last time we talked about the fact that a lot of the women in the Bible that were great women were barren women. And that God actually caused them to be that way so that later when they prayed that he might open their womb and the son that was born would even be more magnified by the result of his providential birth than he would be by any regular birth. Now we read of Hannah's prayer in chapter 1, verses 1 to 20. Let's read, not all of that. Well, let's read a little bit of that together. In chapter 1, beginning with verse 1, we won't read for a moment. Let me just paraphrase some of this. In chapter 1, beginning with verse 1, there is a man in Ephraim named Elkanah, and he has two wives. One he loves more than he loves the other. He has a wife named Hannah and a wife named Peniah. Now, he loved Hannah more than he loved Peniah, but Peniah bare children, and Hannah had no children. And Elkanah was a man devoted unto God, and he went up yearly unto the tabernacle to worship God and to seek God. And it came to pass on the day, or one of the days, in verse 4. Let's read together in chapter 1, verse 4. When the day came that Elkanah sacrificed, he gave to Peniah his wife and to all her sons and daughters portions, but unto Hannah he gave a double portion, for he loved Hannah, but Jehovah had shut up her womb. And a rival, that is Peniah, provoked her sore to make her fret because Jehovah had shut up her womb. And as he did so year by year when he went up to the house of Jehovah, so she provoked her. Therefore she wept and did not eat. And Elkanah said to Hannah in verse 8, why do you weep? And why do you eat your heart out? Why is it that thy heart is grieved? Am I not better to thee than 10 sons? It would appear as if Elkanah was a little grieved that Hannah didn't find in him something worthy of her love to the point that she didn't need a son. Men just don't understand, do they? I mean, men just do not, I do not, understand the terrific drive that Hannah had in order to have a son. Hannah arose in verse 9, and she went to the tabernacle alone. And she enters the tabernacle, and she begins to be in bitterness of soul and to weep sore. And she vowed a vow in verse 11 of chapter 1 and said, O Jehovah of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look on the affliction of thy handmaid and remember me, and will not forget thy handmaid, but will give unto thy handmaid a man-child, then I will give him unto Jehovah all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head. She said, Lord, I'm not wanting a child for selfish reasons. She said, I'm just simply wanting my reproach as a woman to be taken away. I want the reproach that Peniah, the other wife of my husband, gives me yearly. I want that reproach to be gone. I'll give you the child. The child will be yours forever, and I'll make him a Nazarite from the womb. Now, Samson was that also and didn't turn out too good. But Samuel will be a Nazarite from the womb and will be perhaps the greatest of Old Testament men. Now, she's there praying, and her lips are moving, but no sound is coming out. She's praying in her heart silently. And Eli observes her there, and because most men and most women, when they pray, not only move their lips, but sound comes out, he thinks she to be drunken, and he comes in and rebukes her. And says, "How long are you going to be drunken? Put away the wine from you." And Hannah says, "No, I'm not drunk at all. And no wine nor strong drink have I had. But I poured out my soul before Jehovah. Don't count me a wicked woman. For out of the abundance of my complaint and my provocation have I spoken hitherto." And Eli said to her in verse 17, "Go in peace. Jehovah, the God of Israel, grant thy petition that thou hast asked of him." And she takes that as a word from God. She takes the word of Eli, the faithful priest, that God will grant her petition as a word from God himself. And so she got up and ate, and it says her countenance was no more sad. Now she believes. She believes that God is going to open her womb, and she believes that she will have a son. And in verse 19 and 20, that's exactly what happens. "And they arose up early in the morning and worshipped before Jehovah and returned and came to their house to Ramah. And Elkanah knew Hannah his wife, and Jehovah remembered her. And it came to pass, when the time was come about, that Hannah conceived and bare a son. And she called his name Samuel, saying, Because I have asked him of Jehovah." See, the word Samuel means asked of God. And so she said, "I asked Jehovah for a son. He gave me a son. And so I will call his name Samuel," which means the ask of God. Now, the boy Samuel begins the story there in chapter 1 and verse 21. And continues all the way through, or basically through, chapter 2. And that's the second thing in the life of Eli. This boy is born, and for a good long while, of course, his mother gives him suck and cares for him. And then it comes to pass that she's weaned the lad. Now, it doesn't say how old he is. It just says he's weaned. Now, I've read a lot of different things on what this means. Some believe this to mean that he's 3, and some say 4, and some say 6, and the oldest that I've read is 9. Surely a child is weaned and able to feed himself and care for himself to some degree before he's 9. I've got a boy that's 7, and he's been caring for himself at least for a couple of years in the basic functions of life, of eating and elimination and other things. He's been able to care for himself. Of course, he still needs a woman's care and a mother's care, but he's been weaned. And so that means that Samuel is probably somewhere between 5 and 7 years of age when he's weaned. And as soon as he's weaned, she brings 3 bullocks and 1 ephah of meal and a bottle of wine unto the house of Jehovah in Shiloh, and they slay the bullock, and they offer the wine, and they offer the meal. And she says to Eli in verse 26 of chapter 1, "O my Lord, as thy soul liveth, my Lord, I am the woman that stood by thee here praying unto Jehovah. For this child," she points to the little boy, "for this child I prayed, and Jehovah has given me my petition which I've asked of him. Therefore also I have granted him to Jehovah. As long as he lives, he is granted to Jehovah." And he worshiped God there. Now, I don't know what you think about that, but I count that one holy and one great occasion. And you know, I read a book just the other day written by a feminist, and she's an atheist as well as a feminist. And she attacked this. She said the very idea of a cruel God that demanded this woman bring her son. God didn't demand this woman bring her son. I mean, there's not anywhere in here where God even told her to bring her son. That's what she wanted to do. I believe she had the right to do this. You see, he's not going to be without womanly care. Because we're reading this book of women who serve in the tent of meeting. Like Anna, the tribe of Asher, in the book of Luke chapter 1, who for 80 years has served God day and night in the temple, and not has not even left the temple. There's a lot of women that will be able to care for this boy. She believes that this boy is the Lord. See, she could have no children. She'd proven that in all the years that she'd been with Elkanah and been his wife. She wants a child, not for herself, but for Jehovah. And then Hannah prays, and I'm not going to read her prayer, but you need to, and I'm sure you will. In chapter 2, verses 1 to 10, she prays to God, and there's no bitterness in her voice. There's not even any longing that says, I wish I could keep the boy. I feel sure that in her heart maybe she felt that way. But it didn't come out her lips. She praises God. She's thankful to God to have had the opportunity to care for this boy of Jehovah's for the time that she's had with him. And now she gives him unto Jehovah. Listen to me carefully. If there's a boy or girl that God has given unto you in your house that you haven't given to God, repent. And offer that child unto God, just like Abraham offered Isaac, and get him back from the dead. You see, everything that I have, you and you have, needs to be offered and sacrificed unto God. Now, I want you to notice a statement in chapter 2, verse 11 that's going to thrill you. It says, and Elkanah went to Ramah to his house, and the child did minister before Jehovah, before Eli the priest. Did you know that before a child is 9 years of age, he can be a minister of Jehovah? You know, I never had that thought. I mean, I'd always thought, you know, before babies or boys or girls reach what we call, quote mark, the age of accountability, that they were not in any way accountable to minister unto God or even able to minister unto God. But here's a boy just weaned, 5, 6, 7 years old, and what's he doing? He's ministering before Jehovah. Now, I don't know what he's doing. Maybe he's just going around picking up trash from the tabernacle. I don't know what he's doing. But whatever he's doing, it is a ministry unto Jehovah. He is ministering to Jehovah. Now, beginning here in chapter 2, verse 12, and for several verses, there's a contrast between Samuel, the righteous young lad, and Eli's sons, Hophni and Phinehas, who are wicked men. In chapter 2, verses 12 through 17, their sin is they're not satisfied with the provision that God has made for them. Back in the law, when God was making provision for the way that the priest would be fed, he says, you will boil a certain part, he named it, of all of the sacrifices in a large cauldron or a large pot. And every priest will be given a line, and on that line, a three-pronged hook. And he will cast that line into the pot, and whatever flesh comes up on the three-pronged hook, that will be his daily supply of meat. Well, Eli's sons don't like that, so they go to the place where the beasts are being killed, and they say, give me raw flesh to eat. I don't want boiled flesh, but I want raw flesh. And they took the best, you know, the rump roast or the porterhouse or whatever they counted best. They took that and roasted it rather than boiled it. They were not at all satisfied with what God provided for them. In contrast with that, we read that Samuel ministered before Jehovah. Then in chapter 2, verse 22 through 25, Eli's sons even do more evilly. They commit fornication with the holy women. They commit adultery with the women that serve in the door of the tent of meeting. And Eli hears of it, and his soul is grieved. And yet we read in verse 26, the child Samuel grew on and increased in favor both with Jehovah and with men. Eli and all of Israel is learning not to like Hophni and Phinehas, Eli's two sons. But all of Israel, as well as Eli, is learning to trust in Samuel. And then a prophet comes, beginning there in chapter 2 and verse 27 and going through verse 36, and prophesies against the house of Eli and says that Eli's house will not continue, that Eli's sons, Hophni and Phinehas, will die in one day, and that they will not succeed him as priest. Then in chapter 3, you have Samuel's vision, the whole chapter, 3 verses 1 to 21. Now Josephus says in his history of Israel that the Jews believed that Samuel was about 12 years old in chapter 3, the very age that Jesus was when he came to the temple and confounded the lawyers with his questions and his answers. And Samuel, the 12-year-old boy, if that's how old he is, a junior in age, was asleep one night. He was wakened up with the words, "Samuel, Samuel," and he thinks it's Eli. So he goes to Eli and said, "You called?" And Eli said, "No, son, I didn't call." He went back and he laid down again and he heard the words again, "Samuel, Samuel." And he went and said, "Did you call me, Eli?" And Eli said, "No, I didn't call you. It must be Jehovah." He says, "Answer him next time." And so the words came, "Samuel, Samuel." And Samuel said, "Speak, Lord, thy servant hears." And he gives him a word of doom. And that's the fourth point in Eli's life. The word of doom that comes to Samuel. Samuel is told that Eli's house will be all swept away and there'll be no glory left in it, and that God will raise him up a faithful priest. And in the morning, Eli says, "Was it God?" And Samuel said, "Yes." So what did he say? He says, "I don't want to tell you." And Eli says, "Yes, tell me." He said, "No, I don't want to tell you." He says, "Jehovah do to you and more also. If you tell me not everything that Jehovah said, you don't keep back from me anything. You tell me every whit." And he said, "Okay." God says, "Your house is going to be swept away. You're going to die. Your son's going to die. And all the glory will part from your house." And I love what Eli replied. Eli said, "It," you'll read this in verse 18 of chapter 3, "it is Jehovah. Let him do what seems him good." Well, that's the kind of faith I want to have. Isn't that the kind of faith you want to have? That whatever God does is bound to be right. It's Jehovah, Eli said. Let him do what seems to him to be good. And the last thing that happened in Eli's life, we're just going to call Ichabod. Let me tell you the story of Ichabod. The Philistines come and they war against Israel. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, go with the people to battle the Philistines. And the Philistines are beating Israel. They're whipping Israel because Israel is wicked, led by Hophni and Phinehas, wicked sons of Eli. Well, Israel very superstitiously says, "Let's bring up the Ark of the Covenant. If the Ark of the Covenant is here with us, then surely victory will have to be ours." And the Ark of the Covenant then is gotten from the tabernacle and it's brought into the place of war. And when the Ark of the Covenant enters the camp, the Philistines are afraid because they believe that Israel has brought their God into their camp. You know, sometimes when men are afraid, they fight even the hardest. I'm told by some men that have studied war that most of the men that have won Congressional Medal of Honor were really cowards that got cornered. I don't know if that's true or not, but I know I had a dog growing up that was part collie and part chow. He only got his tail from the chow. The rest of him was pure coward. And he just, you know, you pull on his tail, do anything you wanted to him. But one day I saw a Doberman pincher get that coward backed up into a corner, and before I could get there, the pincher was dead. Nobody fights like a coward corner. The Philistines are frightened. And so they said, "We've got to fight even the harder because their God is in the midst of their camp." So they fight and they defeat the Philistines. They take the Ark of God and they kill Hophni and Phinehas. One man escapes the battle and he goes to tell Eli. Now Eli is an old man and he's fat and he's sitting on a log. And this man comes and he finds Eli sitting there watching, looking down the road, heart trembling for the Ark of God, wondering what's happening, not only to his two sons, but primarily that precious Ark that he was the high priest and therefore the guardian of. And the word comes and says, "Hophni and Phinehas, thy sons are dead, and the Ark of God is taken." And in chapter 4 and verse 18, it says, "It came to pass at the mention of the taking of the Ark of God that Eli fell from his seat backward by the side of the gate, and his neck brake, and he died, for he was old man and heavy. And he judged Israel 40 years. Samson had judged for 40 years, and now Eli had judged for 40 years. His daughter-in-law, Phinehas' wife, is with child. And she's about to be delivered. And she hears the tidings that the Ark of God is taken, that her husband is dead, and that her father-in-law is dead. And she bowed herself and brought forth her son, for her pains were very great. And she died in the bringing forth of the son." And yet I read in verse 20, chapter 4, And about the time of her death, the women that stood by said, "Fear not, for you're about to bring forth a son." And she answered, not, nor did she regard it. And she named the child Ichabod, which means no glory, saying, "The glory is departed from Israel, because the ark of God is taken, and because of my father-in-law, and because of my husband." She cried, "The glory of Israel is departed, for the ark of God is taken." Eli ends his life in Ichabod. He ends his life in no glory because he did not restrain his sons. Surely those of us that are fathers need to learn to teach, to train, and to restrain our children. Now the life of Samuel. Of course, a bunch of us already been covered. But the life of Samuel alone is from chapter 5, 1 through chapter 8. And there are only four things in Samuel's life, and we can cover them very quickly. Because Samuel's life is wrapped up primarily in Eli and primarily in Saul and David, who will become the first two kings of Israel. The first thing in Samuel's life is the ark. He goes and recaptures the ark in chapter 5, verse 1 through chapter 6, verse 21. The Philistines thought they really had a prize in the ark of God. So they carried it into the house of Dagon, their god, and sat it before Dagon, you know, boasting to Dagon, "Hey, we captured Israel's god." They come in and the next morning, and Dagon has fallen over on his face before the ark. Well, they set Dagon back up on his stump. And they come in the next morning, and Dagon has fallen over, and his head and his hands are broken off. Dagon can't stand before Jehovah. You see, there's no gods of the Philistines that can stand before Jehovah. And then that city begins to be afflicted with boils. And they move the ark to another city, and it's afflicted. And they move the ark to another city, and it's afflicted. And finally, they carry the ark outside of Philistia and sit it down just outside of Philistia in Israel. And Samuel goes and gets the ark and carries it home. You know, I really think that that's some story that needs to be learned from. I think you and I need to understand that there is no political power, there is no social power, there is no religious power that can stand before our God. And I think the wicked need to learn a lesson, that is, leave God alone. The second thing in Samuel's life is the defeat of the Philistines. And you'll read this in chapter 7, particularly verses 1 to 14. Now, Samuel's no warrior. Samuel is a prophet and a priest and a judge. He holds all three offices that Jesus holds and is probably the most typical man of Jesus in all of the Old Testament. He's no warrior at all. But he's going to do what all of the warriors had not been able to do. He's going to subdue the Philistines. And he fights them in two battles, and in two battles totally subjugates the Philistines. For the first time in over 100 years, the Philistines do not oppress Israel. After he's defeated them, he does something I think we need to read. In chapter 7, verse 12, the Philistines have been defeated. Samuel is now victorious. Then Samuel took a stone and set it between Mizpah and Shen and called the name of it Ebenezer, saying, "Hitherto by thy help we've come." He raised an Ebenezer. You ever sung the song, "Here I Raise My Ebenezer"? Did you know what you're talking about? You were saying, "I've gotten this far by the help of God. I suppose I can go the rest of the way." And that's what Samuel is saying. "I've come this far by the help of God. I don't see anything that will hinder me in the future." He recaptured the ark. He defeated the Philistines. The third thing that I know about Samuel was he was a circuit judge. I read of that starting in verse 15 of chapter 7. "And Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life. And he went from year to year in circuit to Bethel and Gilgal and Mizpah. And he judged Israel in all those places. And his return was to Ramah, for there was his house. And there he judged Israel, and he built there an altar unto Jehovah." So he judged in Bethel, in Gilgal, in Mizpah, and in Ramah. At set times, I'm sure, he would be there to judge the children of Israel. Now, chapter 8 is the last point, and that's the people want a king. Now, they want a king because the two sons of Samuel that are named there in chapter 8, verse 2, Joel and Abishai, are wicked fellows. They take lucre. They take bribes. They pervert justice. Isn't it strange that Samuel, the best of men, had ungodly sons? Maybe Samuel had been too busy recapturing the ark or defeating the Philistines. I don't know. It doesn't say here. Nevertheless, Samuel has two wicked sons. And so the children of Israel come and they say, look, your sons walk wickedly. They're not good men like you are. Therefore, we want a king. Give us a king to judge us. Give us a king that he may go out to war with us like all of the nations. But Samuel is grieved at that. For Samuel believes that they have rejected him as leader. So he goes to God and he talks to God about it. And he says, what shall I say? And God says, you go tell them, number one, what kind of king they're going to get. And don't be grieved that they want a king. Because they've not rejected you, Samuel. They rejected me. You never were king. You were only judge and prophet and priest. I've been their king all these days. So they don't want me as king anymore. They want a man to be king. But I want you to tell them what kind of king they're going to get. I want you to tell them that they're going to get a king that will draft their sons into the army. I want you to tell them that they're going to get a king that will take their daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers in his house. I want you to tell them that they're going to get a king that will put an income tax on them. That'll take away 20% and 30% of what they make. I want you to tell them that they're going to get a king that will come and take the first of their crop, take the first that grows, and that they're going to have to live on what comes up second. They're going to have to live on the dregs. And Samuel went and told them that that's the kind of king they wanted. And these stupid people said, give us a king. I think if he'd have told me that's the kind of king I wanted, I'd have to think I don't want a king. You know, if I could vote today to do away with some of the things in America that I just named that Israel was going to have, I believe I'd vote to do away with them. I'd rather not have that kind of king. But these people are so set in having themselves to be like the nations round about that they'll take a king no matter what kind of king they're going to get. And God's going to give them a king from Judah's tribe, David. But before he does, he's going to give them Saul to teach them that they ought not to have wanted a king. And to teach them the kind of king that won't do them any good. Now, in our next lesson, we're going to start to study the United Kingdom, the period of the kings. And we're going to study Saul, a great man at first, and yet one that will cause Israel all kind of trouble. Hope you continue with us in that study. May God bless you as you continue to study His Word.
Seek ye first the kingdom of God, and His righteousness.
These lessons are available on video cassette tapes for use with video cassette players or TV station broadcasting. Audio cassette tapes are also available. This systematic study of the Bible was designed for a variety of uses: teacher training programs, substitute teacher needs, community Bible study programs on local TV, and hospital closed circuit programs, to mention a few. God bless your study of His Word.